Hey, Grace and Peace Church, I hope you are well. There is this simple question that everybody asks that I think is becoming really complicated. At least it is for me. It's the question, how are you doing? This used to be a really easy question for me to answer. And I feel like it's becoming more and more difficult as I want to remain authentic to the moment and to be honest with people as I sort of go throughout my day. For me, I have these moments of tremendous hope and joy. But then like right underneath that layer, there's also the reality that I have many moments throughout my day of heartache and sadness and despair. And so I find myself kind of going up and down through these two layers. And so to answer the question, how are you doing? I find simple questions like that in this moment are becoming hard to answer. Another question that's floating around right now all over the place are people asking the question, why is this now happening? Trying to crack the code and figure out why. I think that that's not a terrible question, but I think there's a better question that's going to be more fruitful in this season for you and for me. And it's the question, what is now becoming possible? Are there things that are beginning to become possible that maybe weren't a month ago or 2 months ago? And maybe it would be wise for us to check in with some of those possibilities and what might actually come forth through your life if you were to be attentive to it. Today, what I want to suggest is that the scripture wants to speak directly into this creative question. What is now finally becoming possible? So let me start by telling a story of a legend from the Far East. There was once an old man and a son whose horse ran across the border away from them, lost forever. When that happened, the village was sad for them. To which the old man replied, "What makes you sure this isn't a blessing?" Months later, the horse returned. And the horse didn't just return, it brought a stallion with him. And the village was happy for them. But the wise man replied, "What makes you sure this isn't a disaster?" The power of the stallion made their farm rich. But one day when the boy was riding the stallion, he fell off, leaving him paralyzed, and the village was sad for them. But the wise men said, "What makes you sure this isn't a blessing?" Soon after, a war began, and it required every abled man to join the fight. And in that war, every man in the village died, except the son, who had to remain home because of paralysis. And there together with his father, they lived out their days taking care of one another. You know, when I first read this legend, it reminded me of life's radical twists and turns, which can leave us without really good explanations. And I think that there are times in our lives where our blessings seem to turn into disaster. If you ever read Job, you know that that's part of our narrative. That's part of the lineage that we come from as followers of Jesus, these stories of lamentation, that there are times where the blessings of life seem to evaporate into disaster. But I would say that there are also times where disasters in our life can actually bring about blessing. And in a moment where everyone is asking, why is this now happening? May the church be creative to go beyond this question and to ask, what is now becoming possible? Would you turn with me to John chapter 5? We're going to spend some time this entire chapter. Every single week, we give you the text leading up to the week so you can meditate on it, reflect on it, ask the Holy Spirit what you want God to reveal for you in order to walk in the way of Jesus. And so we've been in chapter 5 this week. And so I'm going to teach on this chapter and sum it up and focus on a few key verses. Chapter 5, verses 1. Sometime later, Jesus went up to Jerusalem for one of the Jewish festivals. Okay, let me stop here for a second. Jewish festivals, there were at least three of them every single year. Here's a sort of image of pilgrims on their way to the Jewish festival as they're sort of moving from whatever town or village that they're from toward Jerusalem. And what would happen is everyone would gather and the city would hum in this time. Here's a modern day sort of view of what it would look like in one of these festivals when people come from all over the surrounding regions to remember their story. Here's another picture of one that you can find. I think one of the things about these sorts of Jewish festivals for me is that it helps us sort of understand the texts when you read things like Jesus slipped away from the crowd. You can see in sort of moments like this near the Western Wall with festivals today, how it would be very easy for someone to sort of get lost in the crowd and slip away. Now in verse 2, it says, "Now there is in Jerusalem, near the Sheep Gate, a pool, which in Aramaic is called Bethesda, or Beit Hezda in the Hebrew, from Hesed, meaning house of mercy or house of grace here, which is surrounded by five colored colonnades." Okay, let's look at this word Sheep Gate for a second. Here's a replica of a model of Jerusalem as to how they think it would have been. You can see the little Sheep Gate here. And it was actually the gate where the sheep were brought to be sacrificed at Passover. Now, Jesus comes toward this gate through which the sacrificial vessels of purification and healing would enter for Passover. So I hope you can appreciate what John is trying to imply here in this narrative. And you can see below the sheep gate, you can see these pools of Bethesda. Here's an excavation of what Bethesda would look like today if you were to go and visit it. They've actually found where these pools were, and they've been able to say this is where the cutout was, right? Now, these pools would have been no small deal. We're talking about, go to that next slide. We're talking about at least 20 feet in depth and probably a football field in length. So in other words, this was no small thing. You can imagine it was built to house a lot of people that needed healing. Verse 3, "Here a great number of disabled people used to lie, the blind, the lame, the paralyzed. One who was there had been an invalid," hang on to that word, "for 38 years. 38 years. Here's a Danish painting from the 1800s by Carl Bloch, who captures a really interesting moment aside from the white Jesus here. I think it's a fascinating image to kind of reflect on this man sitting next to the pool that is unable to use his legs. Now, there was a legend at this time that angels would descend, stir up the pool for healing, and whoever got to the pool first would be restored. And if you're a nerd like me, maybe you like Greek myths and the Greek mythology, you can look up the Greek god Asclepius and find out how that myth probably influenced Jewish practice in this way. But we don't have time to get into that today. Now, here's a recent image of invalids that were photographed in Jerusalem, of what sort of invalids, to give you a picture of what that looks like for people. What they would have said, oh yeah, that's an invalid that would be sort of similar to what an invalid would have looked like in biblical times. I want you to notice this word invalid, this word that's in the text, that society sometimes refers to as these people. Notice the word invalid is composed of the words invalid. Think about that word. These people are not considered a valid part of society. That when we use the word invalid, what we're saying is this group of people that we lump together are not actual meaning contributors. We don't see them as having any inherent value to who we are and what we are about. These people were not considered a valid part of society. These are the blind. These are the lame. These are the leprous. These are the paralyzed. And they were to remain outside the temple grounds and to pray by chance that they could get into this pool in time. Now, many scholars debate and agree with what we're dealing with in this story with this particular man would be what we refer to today as a paraplegic. And there are all sorts of problems associated with this man's situation in life. The first is this: he has the problem of mobility. He can't actually get to the pool because he doesn't have use of his legs. The second thing is this: he probably has the problem of social isolation, the social distance. I mean, the question I'm asking when I read this text is, where is his family? Where are his friends? Where are the people that knew him as he was growing up that could put him in the pool in time? My guess is that this was seen as an impure group of people, and so it is best to distance yourself, to socially isolate them from actually being a meaningful part of the community. Can you imagine 38 years of this? I mean, you talk about psychological trauma of what this man must have felt. The third thing is problems of hygiene. Paraplegics often do not have bladder control. So you can imagine this man laying in his own urine and probably smelling pretty bad. I mean, the humiliation when you consider all of the factors that this man is juggling when Jesus comes into his midst, all of these sociological, emotional, psychological factors that he's dealing with that have been on him for so many decades. Like, you have to imagine, like, him crawling around on the dirt to get from place to place, begging at the Jerusalem gates. And the point is this: if I were this guy for 38 long years, I'd probably be pretty bitter. It would be very easy to give up on God, on healing, on any sort of hope in life. It made me think a little bit of Lieutenant Dan from Forrest Gump, right? So you have this pool, and it's located outside the temple gates, but it wouldn't have been sanctioned by the Jewish religious establishment as a legitimate place of healing for Jewish practice. Here's my suspicion. I think that the religious establishment turned a blind eye to this practice, right? This practice that had Greek mythology and weird things interlaced. I can't see the religious Jewish establishment saying, oh yeah, that's part of Torah, because it wasn't. But I think they made allowance for it because it relocated the disabled people of their time into a place on the north side of the temple, out of sight, out of mind. So when the pilgrims are coming to the city from all their surrounding villages and towns, they don't have to interact with them. They can relegate them to the margins. But that's not what Jesus does. Here comes Jesus. Verse 6. When Jesus saw him lying there, learned that he had been in this condition for a long time, he asked him, "Do you want to get well?" "Sir," the invalid replied, "I have no one to help me into the pool when the water is stirred. And while I'm trying to get in, someone else goes down ahead of me." And Jesus said to him, "Get up, pick up your mat and walk." At once the man was cured. He picked up his mat and walked. The day on which this took place was a Sabbath, and so the Jewish leaders said to the man who had been healed, "It is the Sabbath. The law forbids you to carry your mat." But he replied, "The man who made me well said to me, 'Pick up your mat and walk.'" So they asked him, "Who is this fellow who told you to pick up and walk?" And the man who was healed had no idea who it was, for Jesus had slipped away into the crowd that was there. So we pick up in verse 16 here, skipping down a couple, and it says this. So because Jesus was doing these things on the Sabbath, the Jewish leaders, right, primarily the Sadducees in this moment, began to persecute him. The rest of the chapter, if you read on through the rest, it turns into a debate about Jesus's authority, right? And Jesus is going to say that he has the authority of the Father, that he's under the authority of the Father, that he's over John the Baptist, that he's even over Moses, would have been no small deal, and that he is Lord of the Sabbath. The man carrying his mat on this particular day, in this time on the Sabbath, is this like ember that sets the story on fire. This whole catastrophe develops of them questioning the authority of Jesus. Essentially, they're asking, who does this healer think he is? Jesus, who do you think you are to come in here into our house and to go against our rules that we've set on top of the Torah? You're not interpreting the law the way we do, and we have problems with that. So the difference is this, and I think here's the crux of what this text has to teach us today. If we miss this, I think we miss everything. The invalid man, the invalid man, receives the gift of Sabbath. The Sadducees resist the gift of Sabbath. It's the complete opposite of what a reader might expect. It's the one you didn't expect that actually was open to the move of God. And it's the ones you would expect who knew the Torah, that had given their life to it, that totally missed it. That every day we believe God's presence is available in the world. You know, one of the things that happened in 70 AD is the temple curtain was torn and the presence of God is not just located in this place, but floods into all the earth, right? And so every day we believe that God's presence is available in the world. But I would suggest that on the Sabbath day, every single week, there is a double portion of the presence of God that is available for those who will seek it, for those who want it, for those who will pursue it. The Sabbath after the year 70 AD, it became even more important to the Jewish people. Why? Because the Jews no longer had a place called the temple where they could worship, a place where they would gather and worship. They no longer could gather together and worship. Doesn't that sound familiar, right? Sounds a little bit like the season that we're in. And I think what this text wants to make clear for us is just like the Jews after 70 AD, realizing that they can no longer gather meaningfully like they did before, God doesn't just make the presence available in a space. God makes the presence available in a time. This is a time that we call Sabbath, where I want to suggest there is more possible and waiting for us than we are aware of. The question Jesus poses to this man is the question that he's still posing to us today. Do you want to get well? I am the invalid. You are the invalid. The invitation of this text is to be more like the invalid than the religious leader. This season, many of us have entered a kind of extended Sabbath, if you will. Like many, not all. I know some people are working more than they ever have before, but statistics tell us that many of us have more time and space than we've had for years. And we can spend that energy resisting it, or we can spend our energy receiving this season for what it is and finding gifts that might be hidden within it. Do you want to get well? I'm waking up in many ways this season to admit that for the past few years, there have been areas of my life where I've not actually been well. You know, I think it's easy to look, oh yeah, we want mental well-being for those people or emotional or physical well-being for those people. But I think what this season is waking me up to is to sort of take a hard look at my own life and to name the fact that there are areas of my life where I have not been healthy. There's not been shalom. There's been neglecting and avoiding of things that I have believed God has been calling me into for some time, but I had a bunch of excuses for not stepping into. And maybe you feel like that too. Maybe you feel like that. I have often overworked and underslept. And my family has paid the price for this. My diet has sometimes been very poor. As I steward my body, the temple, I've not exercised as I should. I've worried about so many things that I have no control over. I've stared at screens at times to avoid actually sitting with reality. And I would just say to you, as the church in which I call home, I've not practiced Sabbath very well. I've neglected it often. I've resisted it in my own way. And every single week, we have this day called Sabbath that's meant to function as a reset. That's kind of a buzzword that's going around the people of God right now, that maybe God is wanting to reset our hearts and begin them afresh and anew, to ground them in something, a reality check, if you will. In some sense, our society right now, our world right now, has experienced a gigantic reset, a kind of extended Sabbath. And I'm really curious if there's not actually a double portion that God is pouring out on all of us if we will accept it and fully participate in this present moment with the God who loves us. So when this season comes to an end, and it will, someday it will come to an end. When that is, who knows? And when this season comes to an end, I believe God is going to hold me accountable to how we actually utilize this season, how I used my time, how I stewarded this space, this moment. Today, I think there's two temptations and an invitation for us. The first temptation that I think a lot of us fall prey to is the idea of nostalgia, trying to get back to another time. If I could just get back to that time in my life, then I could feel like at least I would be able to go to my favorite restaurant or to my favorite pub or wherever you would sort of say, oh, I missed this. And the goal of life is to get back somewhere. So we spend a lot of time remembering the good old days, even though they might have been like 2 weeks ago or 2 months ago, rather. Another temptation at this time, I think, is to try to move forward, to try to go into like master planning, to try to control the future. If you've ever read the Epistle of James, I believe it's chapter 5, he says, who are you to say you're going to go to this town or this city and do business here in a year and make a profit? He says, your life is a vapor. And in some ways, this season is waking me up to the reality that I am not in control like I once thought I was. And so I would say that the temptation of nostalgia to go to the past, then the temptation of planning to go into the future, both of these are resisting strategies that fall in line with the Sadducees on the Sabbath, resisting what God is doing right now. The invitation for us, I think this is the way the invalid man responded. It's attention. It's attention to the present moment. Attention to say, I can't go back. The future will someday come, but I can be fully here. Let tomorrow worry about itself, Jesus would say. What is for me to do now? How do I step into this difficult moment and try to find the hidden gifts that are buried within it? Let me ask again the question that we began with. What is now becoming possible? Do you want to get well? What are you giving your attention to this season? Your attention is where your present is, where you are fully present. What are you giving the attention of your life to right now? Forbes magazine recently had some data that came back that reported that in this moment, many Americans have more time and space than they have ever, and that we are using it to drink excessively, to eat poorly, to play video games, to watch porn, and to smoke pot. Someday, you and I are going to sit around with loved ones, and we are going to reflect back on this season, and we are going to tell stories. And the stories we will tell have everything to do with what we will give our attention to in the present. Will our stories be around a Michael Jordan documentary, right, which is pretty good, by the way? Will our stories be about Ozark or The Tiger King or American Idol season 4,243? Or will you have stories to tell about how this was a moment that opened up new opportunities for you to step into the wonder of God? An invitation that maybe you have been resisting for years, having all sorts of really good excuses as to why you can't quite get to that place and rest in that way. But now you have time to attend to it. Like the disabled man, when the presence enters your midst, I find that interesting. The disabled man doesn't go to the presence of God on the Sabbath. The Sabbath comes, the presence of God comes to the man. And I think that's what God is doing, at least in my heart and in many of my friends' hearts that I'm hearing around the country, is that it seems like the presence of God is rushing in to meet this moment. And when the presence of God enters your midst, which I think might be happening in a double portion this season, of people turning their hearts back to what matters most, will you receive it? Or like the religious establishment, will you resist it? Amidst all the lamentation around us, and there is a lot of it, and it is very real, I think there's also an invitation, a divine invitation from God to step into new rhythms and new ways of being that are going to lead us back to what it means to be fully human. You know, when earth resumes and you return to it, we'll call that tomorrow, right? When tomorrow comes, whenever tomorrow comes, we know that it will eventually come. When tomorrow comes, here's the question. Who will you be? Tomorrow will come, that day where we can return to the earth, that day where we can return to life in some way, shape, and form. Who will you be? The answer to that question is determined by your answer to this one. Today, how will you live? Who you will be is determined by how you will choose to live and set up life in this season. My encouragement today and application would be simply to take time, if you haven't already, and write out a kind of commitment pledge to pursue the healing presence of God in your life. I think God in my own life wants to increase mental well-being, emotional health, physical attunement, this kind of spiritual desire of waking me up to places where I've been asleep. And I'm struck by how simple the healing touch of God might be in this season. Like, here's what I've committed to, just as an example. This isn't like a list of, check me out. It's like a list of saying, I want this message is for me. And I want to commit to pray often, to have times in my day that are committed to the rhythms of prayer, of intercession, of confession, of contemplation, of being with God, of surging and channeling my heart into what I long for in the world, the kingdom to come, to have prayers of the day where I have carved out several times a day. I want to pray often. I also want to read deeply. I've found one pocket of the day where no matter what's happening, I can just give to reading something deeply and chewing on that from the scripture or from a book that challenges me and engages my soul. The third is I want to eat well.